Okay, gentlemen, let's get our rules of the road straight. We're going to a place called Monster Joe's Truck and Tow. Now, Monster Joe and his daughter Raquel are sympathetic to our dilemma. The place is North Hollywood. So a few twists and turns aside, we'll be going up Hollywood Way. Now, I'll drive the tainted car. Jules, you ride with me. Vincent, you follow in my Acura. Now, if we come across the path of any John Q. Laws, nobody does a fucking thing till I do something.
Right.
What did I say?
Don't do shit unless.
Unless what?
Unless you do it first.
Spoken like a true prodigy. How about you, Lash LaRue? Can you keep your spurs from jingling and jangling?
Mr. Wolf, look, the gun went off. I don't know why. I'm cool, I promise you.
Fair enough. Now, I drive real fucking fast, so keep up. If I get my car back any different than I gave it, Monster Joe's gonna be disposing of two bodies.
You think you got any thug in you?
But Bud White is a valuable officer.
White's a mindless thug.
We're not intimidated by thugs.
Mugs, pugs, thugs. Litwits, halfwits, dimwits.
Thug means never having to say you're sorry.
Hey, everybody. This is Jim, and just wanted to let you know we're doing something a little different this week. This week, for those of you who follow us on Twitter or on Facebook now, this was the 19th annual Austin Film Festival and Conference. And to put out a show, we really had to decide between not doing a show, trying to force a show, or being a little innovative and actually let the festival be the show. So we decided to go with part three on that. So what we've put together here is a collection of some of the best interviews and little segments that we were able to get during this year's festival. I'm not going to set them up or anything like that. I'm just going to kind of let it go through and let the parties involved introduce themselves and let you know what's going on. We got a good mix, and I really hope you enjoy it.
So this is the first ever recording that we've done at the Austin Film Festival. This is Jim.
This is Carson.
And we are with...
Jill Gambaro.
Jill Gambaro. So what brings you to the Austin Film Festival first off?
I'm a writer-producer.
Uh-huh.
And I've been hanging out in Austin for a couple of months looking at the talent here.
Uh-huh.
And I find that there is a number of talented people here.
Austin seems to attract a lot of that, at least for Texas. We seem to be the most welcoming for that kind of thing here. So specifically, what's your involvement with this year's AFF?
My involvement this year is I have a couple of films that have recently been released, and I'm promoting them here at AFF. We're not in the festival, but I'm promoting them.
Well, neither are we, so we're doing the same thing.
Okay.
Yeah, we're doing the same thing, yeah. So what are your films? What do you got? I know you got a documentary and a feature, right?
My feature is called Letting Go. It's directed by Jake Torum, a very talented young director. And
right.
It's a kind of a romantic comedy.
Mm-hmm.
We won Best Romantic Comedy at Houston Film Festival
last year.
Yeah.
Nice. Awesome.
And it's about a man whose life is really out of control, and he's got these three enormous dogs that live in too small of a space. So we've been, the great part about that is that we've been promoting the film through our own digital marketing campaign on the dog angle. And so instead of going to look for the usual indie film reviewers, we've gone to dog outlets. Like we've gotten on Dogster and ChazTheDog.com, and we've gotten a lot of great reviews and a lot of great
What's funny about this is we have been centered from one thing. We have had one stance on pets since this show began, and that is... the cutest kitten is uglier than the prettiest dog because that kitten will eventually be a cat, whereas that puppy will grow up to be a dog, and dogs are objectively better than cats.
Well, so
you can't argue with it.
You can't.
It's not an argument.
Even if you don't agree, you best just let this one go and say, yes, you're right.
Well, as a cat person, I would want to agree, but, you know, the star of Letting Go is... 125-pound St. Bernard named Dragon. And
how do you not love a St. Bernard at all?
Yeah, how do you not love a St. Bernard? But the funniest thing is, you know, in our marketing campaign, we have Dragon blogging from the set because he thinks he's actually going to direct the movie.
Nice.
And
it's very St. Bernard behavior.
Yes, and the problem with St. Bernards is that they drool in incredible ways. And so one of the contests we have going on our marketing campaign is what's the worst dragon drool experience of any crew member? And the current favorite is the cinematographer David C. Smith, who was shooting a scene and while Dragon was drooling down his leg and into his sock, and David had to like totally keep his cool and keep shooting while the drool was dripping into his sock. And so we
that's
give
perseverance.
Yes, it is. What, and that's what you want in a DP.
What I love about the St. Bernard is there's never been a dog that you can look at and immediately say, that is the sweetest, dumbest puppy. Even though they're not dumb dogs, you look at a St. Bernard and your first thought is, that is the sweetest, dumbest puppy on the planet. And you just want
to
hug it.
Well, right. And if you have to actually poop or scoop after...
Oh, God, it's a nightmare.
It's objectively less cute.
Yeah, you'd rather be a minesweeper in Korea than
you need a cherry picker for that stuff, okay? Right. It's not like a little chihuahua where you can just grab and go.
Right.
You need a backhoe. Right.
So what do you have any sort of release where it's available for folks to get this, or are you still looking for distribution?
No,
where can we find
this?
No, we
have distribution. It's on video on demand on everything but Time Warner. And screw Time Warner.
Fuck Time Warner.
I agree.
Right.
Exactly.
We are a firmly anti-Time Warner group right here. Yeah. If I moved to a place where all I could get was Time Warner, I wouldn't have cable.
Oh, there you go. Well,
he wouldn't live.
That's good. Yes.
That's good.
Better dead than Time Warner.
Better dead than Time Warner.
That's our motto.
That is our motto. That's been years.
And we're also available on Amazon.com.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And my other documentary feature that I produced is also available on Amazon.com.
What's your documentary?
It's called Imagine a School Summerhill. Uh-huh. It is about a school in England where the children run the school.
See, what's interesting about that is my normal job, I'm a teacher, I'm right now getting a master's degree in educational administration with a principal certification, and I'll be honest with you, from a lot of what I've seen, if the kids are willing to step up and run it, it can't necessarily be automatically worse than a lot of schools that I've seen. I'm not saying that it would immediately be better, but from a lot of the schools that I've experienced, that's not necessarily, it's not axiomatically bad.
Right. Well, I have to say, I was approached about this project because I really loved the work of the director, William Tyler Smith, who did a documentary called The Third Mind that was about the collaboration between Ray Manzarek, who's the Doors keyboard player, and Michael McClure, the beat poet.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
they started doing performances together that was totally off the hook, and they brought Billy in to start filming it. Billy started doing this B-roll stuff, and it was just amazing. So I really wanted to work with Billy, and he said, I want to do this documentary about this school where the kids run the school, and I thought, oh my God, how am I going to ever sell this documentary, right?
Well, right now, like documentaries about educational reform and revolutionary ideas in education are getting traction just because, and I can say this from the inside, school systems kind of cross-border a little bit effed up. To put it as nicely as possible, what with high stakes testing, needless control from states, and essentially the reason that I'm okay with kids running a school district is they've at least set foot in a classroom recently.
Yeah, that's true.
And
that's
so I'm okay with that idea, as opposed to all these other things where someone's like, oh, yes, I remember taking classes back in the 70s. Like, oh, shut up. You haven't taught for 15 years? Yeah. Don't tell me how to teach them. Please. So where is that one distributed anywhere? Where can one find this?
You can find that on DER.org if you're if you're a school organization, want to show it to multiple people. But if it's just you, it's on Amazon.com.
Awesome.
And I have to say, I was really struck by when Billy came back the first summer with footage from the kids, how emotionally mature and present they were.
Oh,
it was really something, and it really was a convert to me. I mean, when Billy first told me about this idea, I thought, oh my God, he's crazy.
Right.
And then when I saw the footage, I was really blown away at what the potential of human beings to learn is.
Oh, yeah.
It's really incredible.
It really
Are you saying they weren't just mewling numbers?
What?
No, they were. They were
How
not.
How dare you?
That's
close.
Madness.
How dare you?
Madness.
Not
and there's no time for it.
There's.
They were not. Passing tests. They were not
passing tests. This show is over.
Yes. Well, are you trying to say that a standardized test is not an accurate way of gauging a student's achievement and intelligence?
Well, I have to tell you, as a producer in Hollywood that for many years hired interns amongst the graduates of the United States of America, I can tell you that little piece of paper doesn't mean jack because they don't necessarily know how to do anything.
Well, take it a step further. I mean, how many Ivy League grads do you run across that just sound like they've been dipped in dumb as shit sauce?
When I was in college, when I was in college at NYU, I worked my way through college by working at Wall Street at Chase Manhattan Bank.
Wow.
And we would bring in the best and brightest MBA students to work as interns in the summer.
And
we always play this game with them. We would put them at the desk with a desk and a phone on it and not tell them anything and call the number to see what they would do, and 9 times out of 10 they would not know how to answer the phone. And it was hilarious.
That is genius.
Motor skills.
Yeah.
We're at a limit.
Fine motor skills, absolutely. Yeah.
Right, so from someone who's been to a number of film festivals, what stands out most to you about Austin Film Festival?
The thing that's so great about Austin Film Festival is, you know, the city of Austin, they are so good about their support for filmmakers and the community here. They have a sense of community that is just... really, the rest of the country needs to come here and find out what they're doing and how they're doing it so they can model it, because it just makes for, you know, I can go into the local video store and say, hey, I'm a producer and I've done these movies, and they will list the movie, they will bring the movies into their video store just because I live there and I've made these movies.
Vulcan,
and that's incredible.
I Love Video, places like that.
It's incredible. And you wouldn't get that in places like New York or LA or Chicago or, you know, and it's really, it's about a community.
We're an accepting city.
Yes.
We are.
Very much so.
All right. Well, is there anything else that we need? Is there anything else that you would like to pass along here?
I'm raising money for my Detroit urban music project.
Okay.
Is there a Kickstarter for that? Or?
It's not a Kickstarter because I'm raising so much money.
Oh.
I have some of it. I have a third of it. But this is a project that is about the intersection between Motown and punk rock in Detroit in the late 60s. So we're talking
As you can tell by our badge, we're kind of okay with that.
Yeah, right. You guys are okay with that. So we're talking MC5 and Iggy and the Stooges.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, Smokey and Stevie and Aretha. And
beautiful.
Yeah.
That's
so
amazing. God.
That's what I'm
awesome.
Doing here.
Well, where can people find out more about this project?
You can find out more about me and everything I'm doing at www.reflectionmedia.com.
So www.reflectionmedia.com. Check it out and support some worthwhile filmmaking.
Excellent.
Yes.
All right.
This is Rob Thomas, and Rob Thomas is Lisp, and you are listening to the Movie Thug Show.
No,
the film Thug Show.
You know, this wouldn't have happened if it was the guy from Matchbox 20.
Right, right. Yes, okay, there we go. This is Rob Thomas, not the one in Matchbox 20, and you are listening to the Film Thug Show.
Thank you very much. Okay, so we're recording now, so we go. First off, go ahead and introduce yourself.
All right, my name is Taylor Glidhill. I'm originally from New Jersey, but I moved out to California. I went to film school at Chapman University, and my thesis, Boombox Kids, which is about a boy band trying to make it in the 90s, is now here at Austin Film Festival. It's the first time I've been here.
Very nice. Yeah. Is it feature, documentary, what do you got?
It's a short.
Okay, yeah. Which program is it in?
It's in the Bit of Ridiculousness program.
All right, cool. Have you screened, that one screened opening night, right?
Yeah, it screened on Thursday, and it screens again at 10 p.m. this Sunday.
Okay, 10 p.m. tomorrow night, okay. Mm-hmm. So
Where is it screening tomorrow?
I believe it's at the Alamo.
Ritz?
Yeah, I think so. Either that one, there might be two Alamos. Village.
Like,
it's the Village.
Yeah, Alamo Village. Okay, so you got a screening at Village. The other one must have been at the Hideout, man.
Yes.
Okay, cool. So how'd your screening go so far?
It went really well. I mean, the theater was packed with people. I didn't know what to expect because they told me it was a coffee shop, and then it had this hidden, you know, I guess it must be either for bands or for maybe even screenings
they do a lot of stuff back there.
It was really cool. And, you know, the movie it's a movie about music, so we had a bunch of... we had songs written by a guy at Berkeley in Boston, which actually turned out really well. And the thing is, it sounds best when it's played loud.
Right.
It gets people excited. And we've had a few problems where, you know, they play it too low because people get afraid by, you know, how loud it's going to be in a big theater. But, I mean, when it's loud, energy's up and everyone's, you know, laughing, excited. And especially people from, you know, my generation who grew up with NSYNC, Backstreet Boys.
Right.
They saw it and they had all the, you know... It's a spoof, so they see the stereotypes and it's...
Oh, totally, yeah. So thus far, I want to get... What's your take on the Austin Film Festival so far? What are you... Sorry, we're getting a little wind on the mic, so
sure.
I'm just...
Yeah.
There we go. So as a, as somebody who's a not just here checking out panels, but is an actual part of it, what's your experience with the AFF been like so far?
I think it's amazing. I went to South by Southwest actually a couple of years ago when I was in high school. And I mean, it feels exactly the same, to be honest. It's great. It's big. I mean, it's honestly the most professional festival I've been to out of the three so far. The way that these guys are running it is spot on, and everything is really great. You know, they called me to tell me that I got in.
Nice.
I had a person who was actually willing to, you know, work with me through me. They gave me her phone number, so every time I have a problem or a question or something about the festival, like, where do I go for this, how can I get this, you know, nice. Call her up, she's always there. You know, it's just a great place. Austin's a great city too. I love coming back here. I've been here a couple times, and
we really take our art scene pretty seriously.
Yeah,
we're really cool.
And
about
you guys
that.
Get excited for stuff like this. I don't want to like badmouth any cities, so I'm not going to say anything.
No, it's all right. We're like farm people.
I went to
the circus is in town.
There's a few festivals you go to where, you know, I mean, even in like, sad to say, LA, like you go to a couple festivals there where, you know, like just nobody shows up because it's so, you know, but even here, you know, there's such a thriving, you know, music and art scene anyway that it's cool to just see people get excited about coming to see a guy's short from his, you know, college. You know?
Well, and I think a lot of it has to do with what this festival is, just in general, because a lot of the other ones, like South By in particular, it's a lot more of an industry, whereas this one is an artist, it's a craftsman, it's a creative, it's the focus on the writer. And I mean, hell, I was talking to one of the moderators from a panel, and he said there's a no asshole rule. Like, we are told if somebody's an asshole on a panel, let them know, and that person won't be invited back to the festival.
That's awesome.
Like, they don't mess around with it. So what festivals have you screened at, and what else are you coming up on so that folks can hunt it down and find your film?
Let's see. I mean, I don't want to say that this is the end of the line so far. I mean, so far we were at LA Shorts, we were at San Diego International, we've been here, and then we've submitted to a ton of other festivals. Our school has been really helpful with us with the entry fees, et cetera. So hopefully things start coming back.
Awesome.
But we haven't even really touch the East Coast yet where I'm from, and so I've got a bunch of cover letters out there saying, hey, I'm from Jersey, would love to come home, come out and do a Q&A with my film. So we hear back from those, I think starting more in December, and maybe late November. Most of the ones we've submitted to, other than these ones, have been there.
No problem. Do you have a website where folks can get more information or see some parts connected to your film, or just updates?
Actually, we are on Vimeo, but that's not mine, by the way, but okay. That's not my receipt, but I'll sign it for you.
Just witnessed fraud, so ladies and gentlemen.
I'm sure someone's signing mine.
I guess I'm going to tip $100.
Okay, let's see. We're on Vimeo, but right now it's password protected because a couple of the festivals we're trying to get into say, you know, if it's been publicly released, we won't take it.
Okay.
So, I mean, if anyone wants to see the film, I can definitely hook them up with the password and the website link.
Do you have, like, a general site or a place where people can contact if they're interested in getting on?
Yeah, definitely. We have www.boomboxkidsmovie.com.
Okay.
And there you can go check out a trailer. We also have a way for you to contact the filmmakers that goes directly to me and my producer at the same time. So we'll definitely get back to you if you send us an email.
Fantastic. So, I don't know, is there anything else that you'd like to just say about this experience, about your film, about any of it? Like, that, now this is sort of your open mic time. Just have at it, man. riff, baby.
I guess just Austin's a great city. Every time I've come here, it's just, you know, welcomed me with open arms. And the people are great. The panelists have been great. I've talked to a number of them. It's really humanizing to see people who, you know, you recognize as your idols from the credits of shows that you love, just shaking your hand and telling you, yeah, you threw a theme party for my show. That's rad, man. Great.
Awesome.
So, yeah, for the most part, just support local art. It's awesome.
Fantastic. Well, thank you
very much.
Support
it here.
Support it in Austin.
Exactly.
Don't stay home. Come out here.
Yeah, go somewhere. All right, man. Well, thank you very much for the interview. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Hopefully we'll get some folks excited about what you got going on.
Cool. All right.
Cool. Take care, man.
Thanks a lot, guys.
There you go, man.
Hi, this is Damon Lindelof, and you're listening to the Film Thugs Movie Show instead of doing something productive with your time. Shame on you.
Thank you very much, man. There we go. All right, so go ahead and introduce yourself.
My name is Morgan White, and I'm the director of a documentary called The Rep.
The Rep. Okay, I got the other night, the screening I was at your world premiere?
That was the world premiere.
The world premiere, so I was among the first folks to get to see this movie. And it's a
for people who love movies, this is a documentary that is designed for people who love movies. For those who are unaware, it's a rep. Rep means repertory theater. It this movie follows three friends in Canada who opened a repertory theater in, was it downtown Toronto?
Downtown Toronto.
In downtown Toronto, and it followed them through their first year or so of operation, and it's just a really fascinating look at what goes into operating a movie theater at all, and then takes it that step further into, no, it's not a first run, it's not a, it's a, repertory theaters are ones that show movies that are older, the classic films, cult movies, things like that, that are removed from the mainstream or just older. Yeah. And it's really, it's dialed more into the film lover's mentality.
So, well, the whole point of like a repertory cinema is kind of like a, it's a church for movie fans, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You go and you pray to the movie gods and you watch great old movies that you know you don't necessarily normally get the chance to see on the big screen.
Right, right. Now, I'm going to ask you right off the bat, how awesome was it to have your world premiere at the Alamo Drafthouse?
It was pretty much the most amazing thing ever. Yeah. When I got the call that we got into the Austin Film Festival, I literally asked Bears right away. I was like, are we playing at the Alamo? Because I knew, like, that's, it's kismet, right? It's like the perfect place to play. I've always wanted to come to the Alamo,
right?
And I got to come when I shot the film, and that was like the perfect, you know, circumstance to get to come down here and go to the Alamo. And now this is even better.
And you got to you interviewed Lars, and Lars, I don't know if he still hosts it, but for a while he did the Alamo's Weird Wednesday.
Yeah, he still does.
Which for a while was free, and now I think it's like $1 to get
It's like $3 because we went this past Wednesday.
It used to be free, and what I love about this is I think this sums it up perfectly. Lars used to give away prizes before the movie to anyone who could tell him what the most awesome moment from last week's movie was. It was the absolute perfect film geek moment. But what's weird, though, when you look at the Alamo is, especially after watching The Rep, you see that what happened with the Alamo isn't just, it's unheard of. Because the Drafthouse went from a repertory theater to a franchised first-run movie house that is now in San Francisco, New York, they're North Carolina, Kansas,
Denver,
San Antonio, Austin, Dallas, Houston. I mean, they're all over the place. And as I was telling you, and I saw it, to me, the Drafthouse is a dirty little warehouse with a movie theater, with a movie screen on one end of it. And I'm not saying that, oh, they're all dirty, but that was totally the vibe that the Toronto Underground Cinema has, which is the subject of your movie. It is literally in a basement of, was that a condominium complex?
Yeah, it was built in the basement of this old condo that was built in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful old, like, you know, 80s isn't old, but it's a beautiful old theater in the sense that it doesn't look like every other. It's we're in that cookie cutter, just boom, everything's
had
the same.
Had its own space, its own life.
Exactly, yeah.
It actually kind of reminds me of, like, those old mall cinemas that I used to go to when I was a kid in the 80s.
Uh-huh.
Like, that's the style that they were going for. Because it actually is in a mall. There's, like, a mall in the main floor, and then you go to the back, and there's, like, a movie theater there.
That's great.
It's
awesome.
Well, it's amazing because, like, on top of that, it's an old Golden Harvest theater, too. Uh-huh. And that's the reason why it's there. They built it into this Chinese condominium and put in Golden Harvest in the basement.
And for those who don't know, he actually explained this to me the other night, that Golden Harvest found that they couldn't take full advantage of the tax breaks filming in Canada if they didn't have a distribution center there. So they opened this theater straight up as a tax write-off.
Yeah. So that theater, and then there's also one in Vancouver, which is closed now.
Right.
But both of them, from what I understand, and this isn't, like, written anywhere, but this is hearsay, that it's, like, a tax write-off, and it's totally just to get money from the government.
Right, right. Now, what's interesting to me is that they focused on a lot of the programming stuff that they went for in it with, you know, the classic Canadian Cinema Week. And so, what, with those not really playing, because it shows in the movie how those didn't really, they didn't really work with the audiences. I mean, what do you think that was down to in Toronto? Because, you know, Canada is always, the bigger cities in Canada, at least my, have very strong art scenes. So why do you think it was that this just wasn't able to get a foothold within that in Canada?
I think really, like, one of the major problems was always marketing and, like, signage. That theater is really hard to find.
Yeah.
And they didn't have a marketing budget because, well, no independent business really has a substantial marketing budget. So that was a big problem. But there's this misconception that Toronto, to me at least, that Toronto is this film community.
Uh-huh.
Toronto's a film community for 1 week out of the year.
Right.
And that's when TIFF happens.
Uh-huh.
And everyone blows their load on $25 tickets to TIFF.
Uh-huh.
And then they can't do shit for the rest of the year.
Right.
So I think that really had something to do with it.
Uh-huh.
Also, I mean, like, good Canadian cinema was a wonderful idea.
Uh-huh.
But they played all the Canadian films that everyone's already seen.
Right.
Right? They played the obvious ones.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from a couple of things, like, we played... Naked Lunch, which hasn't screened in like decades in Toronto. And we got, I think there was like 40 people that showed up for that.
Yeah.
So that was reasonably good numbers.
Well, and that's what the Draft House was always good about. Like, they used to, back in the day, do a spaghetti western spaghetti feast where it was all you could eat spaghetti and French bread. But they, the first thought everyone has, like, oh, like the good, the bad, and the ugly, it's like, no. They'd play like the Campaneros, and they'd play, you know, I think they might have even shown The Great Silence once, which,
man.
If you've never seen The Great Silence, do yourself a favor. It is. That movie is where it's fucking at so far as spaghetti westerns
there's
go.
There's westerns, and there's westerns with Klaus Kinski.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, really? It's got Klaus Kinski?
As,
right.
the
bad guy. As the
bad guy. So, yes. And a line that we still swear up and down is Klaus Kinski saying, oh, pizza.
He says pizza.
He says pizza. People can say whatever they want, but it's pizza.
Klaus himself could convince me otherwise.
Nope.
That's amazing.
Not at all. Now, what they did in it, too, is some of the special events, specifically where they got Adam West to come. And that was always a signature of the Draft House. Like, you want the coolest event was back when they used to get Bruce Campbell to come here to host the Evil Dead trilogy.
Amazing.
And I mean, and that's what brought people in. But the Draft House, it's a little unfair to compare it to, because you've got the University of Texas at Austin, which is one of the largest universities on the planet, with one of the largest film departments in the world, a few blocks away from it. And I mean, that was when the Draft House opened, it filled a void, because the university had a film program that was going for a while. And this is going to piss you off, Francis, because. It was every single night of the week, there were 4 to 5 movies that you could go see. They had some in Hogg Auditorium, they had some in the Union, but it was all run by the Asian Students Association.
Okay.
So you could see, like, I saw Bullet in the Head, The Killer, and Hard Boiled 35mm prints one night for $5.
It's unbelievable.
The amount of stuff that, but then that went away. They just cut that from just no reason, just cut it. And right about that time, the Draft House hit. And they had, it was weird because they'd always do this mix where it was like dollar cinema, and then at midnight, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure or Jaws 3D, and there are these really cool things that yet you'd still go to. Like, I saw Cool as Ice there, and there were 6 people in the theater.
And it's a crime.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so.
And
it that makes sense. Soul.
There's something wrong with this here. I can't deal with it. Just drop the mic and walk away. But it was this really cool vibe with it. And because of that, it was able to grow. And actually, what a lot of folks don't know, I was here and I knew some folks who worked at the Alamo. The Draft House is as big as it is because they gambled huge and won when they moved to when they opened the Village.
Okay.
And when they opened the Village, here's how ingrained the Draft House was. They opened a four or five screen theater up at the Village.
Yeah, it's 5 screens.
And for the first, I think, 3 months, if you didn't buy your tickets online a day in advance, you didn't get in.
Wow.
Period. Their distributors wouldn't give them new movies. Because they were like, well, we want news. They're like, why? You've sold out every show this week. Why on earth would we pull that? I mean, but then it kind of settled in. And now it's weird to think that this thing that I used to go to on Wednesday nights with my friends is this mecca to every... Because from what you see in that, every single repertory theater in this country looks at the Draft House as, how do we do that?
I think every single repertory cinema in the world now looks at the Draft House. Because the Draft House just worked, and like everything that they do is cool. Like, it seems like everything they touch is gold.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we went out to the Mondo Gallery yesterday, and there was like, we just left because there was no point. There was 250 people outside waiting to get in.
Yeah.
Like, so Mondo was this idea of like, maybe we should do some posters, and then Mondo happened.
Yeah, posters and like t-shirts.
It's amazing.
They started out selling iron-on t-shirts.
That's awesome. Yeah,
and they don't do them anymore, but they used to do heavy metal logos with directors' names.
Yeah.
Like, the Def Leppard was De Palma.
Yeah.
And so it was these really amazing things. But now, what do you think the challenge is? Why do you think that, like, all of those amazing theaters that you looked at, because you went to a bunch of really cool houses, why do you think it is that those just weren't able to connect the way the Draft House did?
You know what? I think the Draft House, to be honest, is just dumb luck.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's, I think that that's what it is. I think if a cinema works, it's kind of just dumb luck, and it happened to be in the right place at the right time, and Tim League is really, like, a great businessman, so that worked.
Yeah. Well, and I can tell you the smartest thing that he did. There was a movie theater in a dorm here called the Dobie that was a fantastic art house theater. Quentin Tarantino used to host a film festival there, and then as soon as they were able to, the Draft House did whatever it took to get the QT Festival to the Draft House. And I think when you've got that to hang your hat on, but how many places does a director with that? And first off, there aren't many directors that have that vocal a love of old movies that collect them and just want to sit and drink beer and watch them. I mean, when it was Tarantino Festival, all that meant was, here's shit from my private 35mm collection, and we're going to sit and watch them. And like, other places don't have that. I mean, granted, you do get the occasional things like with an Adam West or something like that that will give you the one night. But as you saw, there's not necessarily a carryover.
I think it's like access, right? The Alamos had access. Yeah. The other places don't necessarily have access. But even, like, for example, the New Beverly. The New Beverly does have access.
Right.
But they don't always do well.
Right.
They do well in a lot of different things. Uh-huh. But it's really a gamble. The thing is that it all comes down to patronage.
Yeah.
And no matter how hard you try and whatever you do and the amount of people that you get out and whatever, like, it varies and you have no clue what's going to happen, right?
Yeah.
So you could show this great movie that you know is going to sell out 100% and eight people show up.
Right.
Because that is the reality of doing this business.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's always a gamble and it always will be a gamble. And it's more of a gamble now than it ever was.
God, yeah.
Because, like, back in the 70s, when repertory was at its height,
mm-hmm.
that was the only way that you could see these movies. So people would go because that's what they did. Yeah, it was an event.
They had less access to anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Everything.
So now people are a lot more, you know, I think people have become a lot more inclusive. Like, they stay at home a lot more.
Right, yeah.
We live in this, like, society that isn't necessarily all about going out.
Yeah.
It's a lot about staying in.
Uh-huh.
And we have access, like, in the film, there's that shot of the movies on the DVD shelf.
Yeah.
That's my collection.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I have thousands and thousands of DVDs.
Mm-hmm.
And I stay at home and I watch movies every night almost. But I still like to go out to a theater.
Right.
But I'm just one guy. Yeah. Not everybody thinks that way.
Well, because, like, my attitude, I don't go out to the movies at all really anymore, because I used to go all the time. And I have been burned so many times on movies that look amazing and then just suck.
Yeah.
And now I look at it, and we talk about this all the time. Like, I have got, through my cable company, I've got video on demand, I've got Netflix, I've got Hulu, I've got Amazon, I've got video games, I've got my computer, I've got these weird bits of paper that are bound together with words in them that occasionally I'll read. I know.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. You've got all these different things.
Yeah.
There's
so much stuff going on at all times. There's so much access to so many different forms of media that it makes a cinema kind of irrelevant.
Yeah.
Which sounds terrible, but like, perception is now is that the theatrical experience is shit. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You go to the multiplex and there's a bunch of assholes texting and talking.
Yeah.
Right. And the movie isn't necessarily going to be good.
Mm-hmm.
The popcorn's crap.
Yeah.
The way that the theater treats you is crap.
Mm-hmm.
You feel like cattle going in.
Yeah.
So people already have this ingrained concept in their mind that the theatrical experience sucks.
Right.
But what they fail to realize is that that's that theatrical experience.
Yeah.
That isn't the true theatrical experience.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's the marketed, processed version of it. The corporatized version of it. But you have these independents who really try to put on a show and show things in the classic way by having projectionists, which is something that doesn't happen very often.
And that is a dying breed.
That's
now.
A total dying breed, but that's something that's really important. And that's something that, like, I discussed with a bunch of different people when I was doing the thing. There's something that you feel, whether you realize it or not, about being presented a film.
Yes.
You know there's a guy up there behind you who's, like, doing his job to the best of his abilities, presenting you that film.
Yeah.
You know, that's all part of the experience, and that's something that's completely lost by the megaplexes.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think that people now just go, well, why the hell would I pay money to go watch a shitty digital presentation when I got, you know, my Blu-ray player and my television and my Blu-rays?
And they can't, and they won't, but places like Repertory Theaters and Alamo Drafthouse originally did, was offered something other than just watching a movie.
Yeah. And
you can watch it with a beer, or watch it with a burger.
And I really think beer was the key to it.
Well, you see, that's the thing. Like, the Alamo, I guarantee you, And I think Lars was talking to Alex, one of the guys in the movie, about this. But basically, like, on average, they make $20 to $30 a person at peak times, right?
Which is unheard of for a movie theater.
Yeah, it's perfect, right? Because I can't imagine that their Tex-Mex food cost them all that much to make, right?
No. So, no, you know, I can tell you that for a fact.
You are overpaying for that food.
He worked in the kitchen for a while, so he can tell you for a fact.
Yeah, so you are overpaying for that food, which is fine. No, it's great, whatever. But they're making all their money off that, so technically the films are almost irrelevant to them.
Yeah.
Right.
They look at the films the same way that the multiplex looks at the films, in the sense that the popcorn is the big thing for a multiplex.
Exactly, yeah.
But at least this circumstance, they really care about the films.
Yeah.
Right? So the films may be irrelevant in the financial sense, but to them it's like, we present this the way that we want to present it because we care about the movies.
That was the only edge they had in the market, was to be able to offer something other than that. Because the Ritz only showed movies, and that's all it did. We wouldn't be talking about it.
Or
any other repertory theater because of the demand on people's attention.
You overpay for food every time you go out to eat.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so it's fine. At least you're getting, you know, dinner and a show, right?
Yeah. And what I love about it, and this is going to sound so weird to most people, but I'm willing to bet that everyone here is going to pick up exactly what I'm saying. There is something about seeing an old film print that's fucked up.
Oh, yeah.
That's scratchy and kind of green, and it's got hairs on it.
It's
and
there's some frames.
I don't think they're doing that intentionally.
Yeah.
Well,
it's
the cinemaphile equivalent of vinyl enthusiasts.
Yes, yes.
You have to hear the pops real warped.
I saw a screening of The Shining for the Warner Brothers 70th anniversary, and one reel had literally it looked like somebody had just put a fork.
And it's like emotion lines?
And just all the way through it. It's crazy.
I have a print of The Exorcist that is pink as all hell, and I love it because it makes that film actually more creepy.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's like drenched in blood.
Well, that's kind of weird. Patina over the whole thing.
Yeah, totally.
And the best statement I heard on that was one that we saw. I forget what it was, some women in prison movie from and the print was screwed up to the point Lars introduced it saying, "Okay, apparently tonight's movie is brought to you by the color orange." Because the thing was just fucking orange as hell. It was brilliant. But again, that's something that, you know, the number of people would be like, "That didn't look very good, so I'm just gonna like suck it up, dude."
That's the punk rock part of it.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
Here's something really interesting. When I went to the Film Forum in New York, I was talking to Bruce Goldstein, and Bruce Goldstein's like the king of repertory cinema. He saved so many films from the, like, out of the vaults and got new print struck and all that stuff.
Nice.
But he talked to me about, like, back when he first started programming in the 70s. We have no concept of how good we have it with prints. Yeah. Because back then, prints were shit.
Yeah.
Because the studios would make two prints because they didn't spend, there wasn't like the distribution network that there is now where they make 4,000 prints or something.
Right.
They make like, you know, maybe 100 prints. Mm. Two of those would get kept and they would be in the worst possible condition.
Right.
And people would then, you know, once DVDs came out, they'd start watching these movies again and be like, "Holy crap, this is what this movie looks like?"
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And like, so he basically said like a red print matter, it's irrelevant. It's a great thing.
Yeah.
Because that's better than what we used to watch back in the day. Like, right. Back in the day, they'd be scratched all hell and pops and cuts.
What it reminds me of, and this is another very film nerd moment that I think you will pick up on, it's like from Highlander, when he opens the bottle of Hennessy and breathes it, he's like, "This year, this happened," because he's like breathing the air from that year. There's something about saying, "I'm not just watching the same movie that somebody in 1960 watched, I am literally watching the exact same piece of celluloid, the exact same image that they saw." That is so cool.
Yeah.
When you stop and think about it, how many people have looked at this exact square of film throughout history, and it's a connection.
Have either, like, has anyone here ever played with a print, like a 35 print?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
There's something, the second that you start cutting and splicing and playing with a 35mm print, you, like, intensely understand the value of it.
Yeah.
And it's something that's really hard to explain, but the second that I started buying 35 prints, and, like, they just arrive in the mail, and they'd be these big, bulky boxes, and I'd open it up, and I'd grab it, and I'd be like, "This is the real fucking movie."
Yeah.
And, like, I'd put it on the splicer and, like, fix up all the cuts and stuff, because, like, you know, splices get fucked up over time. Like, you develop this intense connection to that film. So, like, I bought a print of E.T. because it's one of my favorite movies of all time. You know, it's one of those movies that I watched when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I never actually got to see on the big screen. And I bought this print and I held it and I was like, "This is movie geekdom to the max for me."
Yeah.
Like, I'm holding something I'm holding something that matters to me.
Yeah.
And like, I have this direct connection to the original time that this was played.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not a toy. No. Or it is the actual that.
It is. It's a time capsule. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
That you can sit there and look at the one frame and be like, holy crap. That purple line with the soundtrack running down the side
it's
of it.
An artifact. From childhood. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a straight artifact. Like, and but there's something that's so amazing just about that. But having houses like that, I mean, do you think that we have reached a point where we are just watching the death rattle of the repertory cinema?
I don't want to sound pessimistic. Uh-huh. It's really hard for me not to be though.
Right.
I think the problem is that there are enough people that want to keep these spaces alive.
Uh-huh.
There's enough film fans out there that should be able to support them. The problem is that we're destroying the buildings.
Yeah.
So, like, if you walk around any city, like, I'm sure in Austin there's a ton of them.
Uh-huh.
But, like, for Toronto, for example.
Uh-huh.
In Toronto, there was 130-something single-screen theaters. You walk around the city, you can see them instantly. You know exactly that they look like movie theaters.
Yeah.
But they're mini marts and fucking furniture stores and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And they're never going to be cinemas again.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the real thing is that a repertory cinema does not belong in a multiplex.
No,
it belongs in a single screen or an old cinema.
Uh-huh.
And those old cinemas are gone and they're disappearing at great rates. So that's really going to impact the repertory cinemas.
There's an old one right across from UT, right by the Littlefield House. That thing, it's a bookstore there on the corner. That was the Varsity Theater until 1993 when it became a Tower Records. And
now that's gone.
Yeah, now it's exactly. They said, gee, movie theaters are dying. Let's go into selling records. That bottom's never fallen out of that. And the only thing that remains of it is a mural covering the wall. It's got like Jimmy Cliff. Jimmy Cliff from The Harder They Fall.
Yeah.
Buster Keaton got stuff from The Seventh Seal. Just this beautiful mural. But it's sad at the same time because you look at it, it's like, that used to be a really cool single screen theater where you could walk from a dorm and just sit there and watch. And now it's a fucking bookstore.
Like, think of like the aura that place has. Right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm not like a spiritual person, but when you walk into an old theater, like, you feel the age of that theater.
Yeah.
And you feel the people
you
that have been in there. Yeah, you smell it totally.
Uh-huh.
And like, for example, that one theater that was in Detroit, that really beautiful old theater that's all fucked up because it's been
vacant for
so many years. Yes, of course. I mean, obviously it's in Detroit, that has its own problems. But like, when we went in there to film, it like, I felt the movie theater.
Right.
Like, it was like, oh my God, I'm in this destroyed theater, but I still feel the movies that played in here.
Uh-huh.
Which is a really weird experience to like feel.
Mm-hmm.
And if you walk into those old theaters that are been converted, you kind of get this sense that like, that was a movie theater.
Yeah.
And you can feel the aura of it. Which is really sad when you think about it, because it's like you're walking in this like death zone of movies.
Right. And it always feels unnatural. Like, there's a place up in Pflugerville. It was this old church. And this beautiful old church that you look at and you go, that's a church. And for the first like 8 years I lived in Austin, it was a judo studio.
Oh, man.
It was this gorgeous church with a steeple and a sign of a guy like, judo. Like,
that's five people at six at night on a Wednesday
and
going to their katas.
Now it's back to being a church, but it's that same kind of feeling.
Yeah,
it's like, how on earth are you sitting there hip throwing somebody in a church? Like, you're going, like, the place that, I forget where it was, like, one side of it was like a coffee shop and the other side was a running store where it's like, fucking really?
Yeah.
Like, and it's weird though, because I do think, as weird as it's going to sound, repertory theaters are gone, but the idea of repertory, I think, is stronger than ever because of just people being able to have access to it.
Yeah, that's like what John Waters says in the film. Like, you know, home video killed the rep because now you can program your own repertory month or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's true, and that's great, but that's still not repertory.
Oh, no, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You were 100% missing the actual point of the film.
Mm-hmm.
You were consuming the film, but you were not experiencing.
You're not having
the film.
You are consuming product.
Yeah. Well, but that's the thing, is that like cinephiles now, that's what we do. We consume.
Yeah.
We don't like, think of how many movies that you actually watch a year and how many of those are actually really impactful.
Yeah.
It's because you're consuming so much material.
Mm-hmm. And the difference between live cinema and watching at home can be the difference between live baseball and television.
Because
you can watch a horror movie 1,000 times at home and not have any impact.
Yeah.
Watch the same horror movie at a movie theater with more people who are actually might be scared, and it's a better experience.
Yeah, totally.
It's like the experience I love to tell, and I think you'll love this. I taught a film history class for a while at the high school where I work, and I showed Harold and Maude one day.
Yep.
The bell rang with 5 minutes left to release the kids to lunch, and nobody got up. They sat there like... And I was like, you guys get... Shh. I'm like, whoa. Like, they refused to leave until the ending of it. And I think that puts... That sums it up more than anything. That whole thing where it's like you connect, and it's like how intelligence gets bigger. Like, when you're working in a writing group and you're all throwing ideas around and you're, smarter, exponentially smarter, it's like the emotion amplifies with the number of people there.
Really?
You know who you... God, I hate... This is worse Monday morning quarterbacking, but you should have talked to Kevin Murphy from Mystery Science Theater 3000, because he wrote a book called One Year at the Movies, A Man's Movie Going Odyssey. You need to find a copy of it and read it, because he, every day for a year, saw a movie projected in public.
Amazing.
He went to multiplexes. He went to the smallest movie theater in the world, the smallest movie theater in the U.S. He went to the movie theater they make in the igloo up in Canada, the Ice Palace Theater.
Okay.
He went to an operating silent movie theater in New Zealand.
Wow.
He went everywhere. And he doesn't talk about the movies themselves that much, just about the experience. Like, they snuck an entire Thanksgiving dinner into a theater. He talks about doing that. He sat in the front row every day for a week. He took five different women to the same date movie. And it's just this amazing look at the culture of film going from the audience's perspective.
Yeah, yeah.
And watching that movie, I was like, God damn, this is like a companion piece to that book.
Well, I'll have to get that book.
Yeah, it's great.
I'll have to send the movie to him.
Yeah, definitely. One Year at the Movies, it's really fantastic. But this, it's weird because I, as much as I like the movie, it pissed me off and made me sad at the same time, because I'm like,
well,
God damn it, people. Don't go see Transformers. Go here and watch something awesome.
Well, that's kind of the point of the film, right? Like, I showed it to a friend, and he called me right after he watched it, and he's like, I feel like I've been punched in the gut. And Lars even said that when he was doing the Q&A. And it's like, that's kind of what I wanted to do, right? Because that's how I feel. Like, I felt like I'd go to these screenings and there'd be eight people that would show up. And, like, those guys felt like they were being punched in the gut.
Yeah.
And I felt that, too. And it's really, it's because the patronage is not there.
Yeah.
The patronage doesn't care as much as they should.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that, you know that concept of, like, we really only care about something until, once it's gone?
Yeah, you don't know what you got till it's gone.
Like, you don't know what you got till it's gone. Totally. And that's really where we're at with these places.
Uh-huh.
So I kind of wanted to make this film that was, like, a wake-up call to cinephiles to be like, you better fucking support these theaters or else you're never going to get to do this again.
Exactly.
You're going to have to work.
Stop taking it for granted.
Yeah.
You're going to have to work really hard to find these experiences. And if there's one thing that cinephiles don't like doing, it's fucking working for finding something. Because we're all lazy, fat bastards sitting.
Especially. How dare you?
I'm not lazy.
I want a sandwich. Yeah. And what's weird is we didn't used to be like that. We used to be the folks that would bust our ass to find stuff. Now, busting your ass to find a movie means spending 20 minutes online hunting down a DVD on eBay.
Or hunting down a torrent file
to
download the thing for free.
Yeah.
It's not on Instant. I don't want to watch it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. No, totally.
The number of times I have said that, and I'm like, fucking... I realize now that I have had the same four DVDs from Netflix for like 3 months. And I don't even remember what they are. I don't even know where they are. I'm like, I'm fairly certain they're on the coffee table underneath some magazines, but I could be wrong. It's so sad. And the fact that I'm even having to call myself out on it. But it's right. We do that. And part of it, too, is finding the theater that will do the screenings that we've got to see. Like, you guys nailed it on that opening night with Big Trouble in Little China and Clue.
Yeah.
I mean, if you don't want to see Big Trouble in Little China in the theater, I honestly don't know how to talk to you as a person. I'm just like,
I don't know you.
It's such a great movie to watch with a group of people because it's so ridiculous. And you watch it at home.
It is not ridiculous. It is a documentary that was shot in real time.
But you know what I mean?
It's kind of real.
You know that. Right.
It's a ridiculous film to sit at home and watch, but you see with a group of people, everyone's laughing at the right moments, and it's really
and appreciating
awesome.
Just. And that's the thing that I think is being lost with the kind of B movies is what like I watch Tropic Thunder is a great one for this. He watched it by himself and was like, I don't fucking get why people like this. I watched it in a packed theater and went out going, that's the best fucking thing I've ever seen in my life.
Somehow,
oh my God.
A miserable bastard sitting alone at home didn't find it so funny.
Yeah, that's true.
Or if I'm in half in the bag and a room full of people, yay!
Whether the studios want to believe it or not and the filmmakers want to believe it or not, films are still technically made for the theatrical experience,
yeah.
Even though that concept is changing.
Mm-hmm.
So something is drastically lost when you don't see it in a theater.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing for new movies as it is for old movies, especially old movies, because those films were 100% made for the theater.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you watch an old Technicolor, like, widescreen movie, that thing was designed specifically. And
yeah.
Then they had formats like 70 and Cinerama that were designed for specific theaters,
oh, yeah,
to give you the greatest large screen experience possible for as many people.
Cinerama is ridiculous.
Yeah, completely.
It's like, we just saw the digital restoration of Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah.
I've seen that movie in the theater like 6 times, and this, it looked so amazing. The restoration they did on it was just jaw-dropping. And but at the same time, it felt a little different because it looked like a movie that just came out this week. And seriously, it looked brand new. And I'm not saying something was lost by that, but it just felt different.
It does. Well, you know, it's that digital thing that feels different. Whether you want to believe it or not, it is different.
Yeah.
100% different. And there is something more warm and rewarding about watching a 35 or a 70 print than there is of watching a digital version.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird, but I have this feeling that it's because film is, like, tactile, it's emulsion, it's
tangible.
It's tangible, but it's more like, it's, what's the word?
Visceral?
It's elements coming together. It's elements coming together.
It's science.
It is science.
Yeah.
It is.
It's
science. But it's light being projected through something and being blown up on the screen.
It's a real thing.
It is a real thing. Whereas digital is just a bunch of ones and zeros being shot out of a CCD.
Yeah.
Right? And that's okay.
Yeah.
And it doesn't look as good because everyone says, oh, you're getting a 4K print, but you're really getting a 2K print,
right,
which is kind of just a Blu-ray.
Yeah.
It's not the same thing.
Uh-huh.
You're not really getting the actual theatrical
It's got some crispness that's really nice, but, you know, it's like going to a concert where everyone sits down.
Yeah.
It's you can see the stage better, and there's not some sweaty punk rock guy slamming into you, but it just doesn't feel the same.
No, totally. It's like listening to a live album on your headphones or being at a concert, right?
Uh-huh.
Like, there's a drastic difference.
Oh, yeah.
And like, it's funny to me that we still, as a society, completely understand the reason to go to a rock show, but don't understand the reason to go to a movie.
Yeah, right.
I don't understand why that is. Because it's the exact same thing.
Yeah.
It's being in a group of people experiencing something that's being presented to you.
Yeah.
So we should see it as the same thing. But for some reason, we get that with concerts and we don't get that with movies.
It's like we're also living in a time where people will be sitting next to each other texting.
Yeah.
Not engaging, talking, not being part of anything.
It's
just passive
because
conversation.
Everyone's inclusive. Everyone lives in their small, centered little world.
Mm-hmm.
And they want everything now, right here, and they don't want to experience it with a group or on the whole.
They don't want it to be challenging or, it's the Louis C.K. statement, you know, everything is amazing, but nobody's happy.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, but the tickets are, and the theater's too cold. And I, like, and you're watching an 80-foot-tall person. You not get that, but a lot of people, they don't. I mean, the Paramount Theater does a classic film series every summer, and it's fucking empty. Like, I saw Dr. Zhivago in a 2,400-seat auditorium with 50 people.
That's depressing.
I saw The Magnificent Seven, and there were maybe 80 people there. But what was awesome about that is when Steve McQueen's name hit the screen, he literally got applause. And you want to talk about getting you into the movie?
Yeah.
That moment does it. But, again, it's all about convenience. It's the kind of the Americanization of the world, where it's like, no, I want it here, I want it now, I want somebody to bring me a pizza while I watch it. Unfortunately, I can't just leave the door unlocked and have the pizza man bring the pizza to me on the couch, and I have to go up and get to the door.
Yeah,
I mean, if you look at it, video on demand is the lazying of DVD. I don't want to have to get up and walk. I'm guilty of it. The number of times I've been in bed and I'm like, I want to watch a movie that I own. Is it on Netflix streaming? No. I just watch something.
I've done that too. And I hate myself for doing that.
Yep.
It drives me nuts after I think about it. I'm like, why the fuck can't I just get up on my ass and go to my DVD collection?
And it's a thing where in the back of your head you're like, you just lost the right to complain about this for a day.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I did. I can't see it.
So, you premiered your film at AFF. Have you submitted it to other...
I've submitted to a ton of festivals. This is the first time it's gotten into anything.
Yeah.
For some reason, I don't know why, it's actually been really hard to get it into festivals.
Well, getting anything into festivals is brilliant. There's a documentary called Official Rejection that goes really in-depth into just the ball-breaking nightmare that it is. I mean, but even with any competitions, I was talking to a guy who submitted a screenplay to the Nickel Fellowship and got to semifinals with his first screenplay, then got that back, brushed it up, cleaned it up, submitted it again, and didn't make it past first round with the exact same script.
Yeah.
It's all this, like, what's
luck,
who happens to see it.
Yeah, no, totally. Hopefully, like, I've gotten some emails now from other festivals that have saw it
And also, having a world premiere at AFF helps.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think, like, the Austin Film Festival is a really great big festival, and it's like the perfect place for this film to be.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's in Austin, it's in a city that understands the importance of cinema, so.
Yeah. Well, and this is the kind of movie that works so well at this, because, you know, and this is what the ultimate irony is going to be. After it goes through all of this and gets distributed on home video and video on demand, then all of a sudden it's like...
Well, it might not, and this is the sad reality, it might not even get on DVD.
Yeah.
Because lots of films don't even get that anymore.
Yeah.
Because it's a physical thing that companies don't want to produce.
Yeah. Right.
They want everything online.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't want the overhead.
Yeah.
And it's odd.
There's actually been a lot of ironies with this thing, and the one that always gets me, and this is something that I get asked about, like, I talk about 35 and film and all that stuff. I shot the fucking thing on digital, and it's like projected and mastered on, like, it's all digital across the board.
What kind of camera do you use?
I use an HDV camera,
okay.
Like the cheapest possible camera I could shoot this thing on, because I literally funded this entire thing out of my pocket, right?
Oh, damn.
Yeah, yeah. It was one of those things where I started shooting the web series version of it, and it was like, oh, I need a little handheld camera, that's fine. No, maybe I'll get something a little bit bigger. So I got a bit bigger of a camera, but still in the same format.
Right.
And I just kept going, and I never upgraded. But I bought things as I needed them. And now I have, like, this whole kit of, like, lights and everything I need.
Well, I mean, the travel alone for this was, I mean, because you guys went everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
So who did you find, of all the theaters you spoke to, who was the most welcoming of coming in and talking to you about this stuff? Or were they all pretty...
They were all pretty welcoming. I think everyone was kind of surprised that somebody wanted to talk about this stuff.
Right.
Like, I remember when I showed up to the film forum, Bruce was like, do you think anybody really gives a shit about this stuff? Like, why are you asking me all these questions? And then we started talking, and he was like, oh, I get what you're doing.
Like,
this
here.
Is... This does make sense.
Uh-huh.
So everyone was a little, like, maybe, like, a little, like, why are you doing this? But this is still really cool, and I definitely want to talk to you. Because ultimately, I mean, like, I'm talking to people about the thing that they're most passionate about.
Right.
What do people like talking about? The thing that they're most passionate about. Like, it's the same thing right now. You guys are talking to me about my film. I have no problem talking to you about that, because it's the one thing in my life that I really care about the most.
Oh,
so
hell yeah.
That's
hell yeah.
The same circumstance. And actually, it was really helpful because I contacted the Alamo first, and I got in contact with both Lars and Zach, but Zach was the one that emailed me back before, Zach Carlson.
Did you talk to Henry at all? Henry Mazza? Does a lot of the programming. He's a friend of mine from college.
Okay.
Started as a waiter and worked his way up to where he was doing programming for him, which is amazing.
Yeah, I talked to Zach, and Zach was like, go here. I'm like, okay. And I called them, and they're all like, yeah, sure. The only other ones were like, when I contacted... The Red Vic.
Uh-huh.
I did that myself.
Right.
They said no like 3 times because of the circumstances and what happens in the film. But then the one guy that's in the movie, he just said, come show up. I'll do the interview. Just come.
Uh-huh.
And then I contacted New Beverly on my own.
Uh-huh. And that's the New Beverly. That's when Tarantino bought the building up, right? That's the coolest. Like, there's a certain amount of respect you gotta have that Tarantino's like, I'm gonna lose money on this. I don't fucking care. That theater, as long as I've got the money to do it, that theater is not shutting down.
Well, no, he bought the building, so they don't have to pay rent.
Yeah,
they still operate as a functioning cinema, and he doesn't actually pay for the functionality of that cinema.
Right.
The cinema funds itself.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we were discussing this, but Mike, the guy that runs it, is fairly sure, and I did a little bit of research, and I think it's true, he's the only for-profit theater in, like a repertory theater in the U.S.
Wow.
Yeah. Because all the other repertory cinemas, or a lot of them, are not-for-profit organizations.
Right.
That's
right.
A really big thing that's happening now, because it provides them the ability to actually last and stay open.
Mm-hmm.
So something like everyone loves the Cinefamily Theater in L.A. That's a not-for-profit. They don't make shit on the movies. Like, they get grants and funding from people. So that's why they get to stay open. And a lot of other theaters are like that.
But it's so cool that something like this exists. So, I mean, what is the plan from here? Are you just kind of like waiting out to hear back from other festivals?
Yeah.
Or but I will tell you this, from what I see, I did an interview with a guy who had a film here last year, and he literally within the week got distribution on it.
Really?
So you can never tell, because there are folks that those do happen, and if nothing else, you're at least getting on the radar with it.
Yeah.
I mean, you had a good size screening of it there. Normally, the movies that they do at the Draft House are in the smaller house.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Last year, all of them were in the smaller house, and I was shocked when they let us up that side. I was like, really? It's in the big house? It's badass. And I mean, you got a good group in there.
Yeah, there was like about 100 people there, which was pretty amazing.
Uh-huh.
I never thought there'd be 100 people that would want to see my movie.
Yeah. And I mean, and hell, you've got one more screening of it, right?
Yeah, we got the one more on Sunday.
Sunday, and where is it Sunday?
It's at the Village.
Okay, Village.
And I think the screen is like 95 people.
Okay.
That's how many it'll fit. So hopefully it'll be sold out. That would be awesome.
Well, and but what's cool about it is where you're going is actually more of an original Alamo than the Ritz.
Really?
The original Alamo is now off Colorado by 6.
Okay.
And it's, I don't know what it is, what it's called now, but it's right next to a hot dog restaurant called Frank, which is awesome. But it's there, and that, it's gone now. You know, it's some other thing. But the first one that they opened outside of that is the Village.
Oh, okay.
And
awesome.
A little bit of history, the Village Theater, that used to be the Village Art Cinema.
Yeah.
It was one of the first two theaters in the country to do midnight showings of Rocky Horror.
Wow.
So that is a place that gave birth to the midnight movie phenomenon.
Awesome.
So you are going to be screening it in a place that's got kind of a double history. That's the reason the Draft House is what it is, and it's part of this other phenomenon that's so huge.
That's
so
amazing.
It's really cool to kind of have that added on top of it.
That's awesome.
Yeah. See, awesome. This is why you get that little inside baseball when you get the locals going on stuff here. Yeah. Outstanding, man. Well, we could honestly do this all day, but I know that you've got stuff you want to do here. So what we can do is just open up and give you your closing salvo. What is your, you know, what else would you like to say in this that we haven't given you the opportunity to?
I mean, I think the film speaks for itself, but essentially my big pitch to everyone is that if you like a theater, support that theater.
Yes.
And if you like movies, support movies in theaters. Support independent businesses, because they're the most important thing in the world right now, because everything's being corporatized, everything's being turned to bullshit. So go and support the little guy and support cinema in a theater.
Here. And are these addresses still good here with the website? Okay, so check them out on Twitter at The Rep Series or at www.thereps.com. Check them out. Send them some love. Let them know that there are people out there who still give a damn about what movies look like. So, man, I want to thank you for taking time out and doing this. And
thank you.
Really appreciate it. We hope your next screening's awesome and that you're able to enjoy the rest of this festival experience,
awesome.
Man.
Thank you
it's
so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Hello there. This is Phil Rosenthal. You're listening to the Film Thug Show, and I can tell you that the Film Thugs will never have a fridge just for soda.
Right, yeah, Austin Film Festival is great for that, because you get people who are just into the writing and the performance of it also.
Right.
All right, we'll just walk it through. I got it rolling here, and I'll...
Oh, you do?
Yeah, I'll set it up and just let you guys introduce. So, all right, well, here we are, Austin Film Festival with Eddie
Pepitone. How are you?
They are assholes.
How is so everybody?
Everyone's great. And
Stephen Fine Arts.
Stephen Fine Arts, the director of The Bitter Buddha, about Eddie Pepitone. Now, he's a... Here's what interests me. I'm going to start out with this question because it's something I've always wondered. A lot of folks on this, just making sure it's recording, describe you as a comedian's comedian.
I know.
What the fuck does that mean?
That means I'm not very popular.
Right.
That means the only people who know me are other comedians.
Right. Means you're good, but not as popular as you should be, pretty much, right?
But it's also like, here's the good part of being described as a comedian's comedian, is that you're doing stuff that comedians love, meaning that people who do this crazy art form known as stand-up, they dig what I'm doing because so many people, I think, do the same thing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They're digging me because I'm doing and saying things that the average comic isn't doing. So then I become a comedian's comedian because they're like, oh, you gotta see Pepitone. Like, this is my peers, you know. Whereas the general populace, no offense, the general populace, you know, find certain types of comedy very appealing.
Yeah.
But they're not particularly interested in, you know, the darker aspects of it or, you know.
Well, it's, it's because normally when you hear that, you know, when folks hear it, it's like CK or David Cross or folks like that are, you know, that when people give it a chance end up really loving it because that difference is really what it is. Because, you know, when you're seeing somebody that's new and different and unusual and doing something that's just fresh and totally original in them, you either get it or you don't. And that's got to be, like, sort of a frustrating thing because you're doing what you do is pretty fucking genuine. And there's no bullshit with it. You're just, you're putting it out there and you're being an actual person and not a quote-unquote person on stage.
Right.
And so that's got a different vibe to it. Now, what I'm wondering is, you said after the showing that there were two people who came talking to you about doing a documentary. Why did you choose to go this way? And conversely,
that was really just an instinctual thing. The other guy, I felt like, was more interested in using me for his ends, whereas I thought Steven was generally interested in me.
Oh, yeah?
And, like, I could tell Steven really dug what I did, whereas the other guy, I felt like he was like, maybe I can make this guy help my career.
Right.
That's what I felt.
Yeah, okay. I can see. And I know we mentioned this earlier, but what was it that really pulled you, Steven, into this world of Eddie Pepitone?
Well, I've been hearing about him for a long time back in L.A. for just like, he is the comics comic, you know, all that kind of bullshit. But you know, you hear from Mark Maron and from Dana Gould and all these guys who really do love Eddie, and they put him on their shows and all that. And I heard Eddie on WTF, a podcast with Mark Maron, a few times, and just the guy, he's just, I've never seen anything like it before. That's kind of what I'm saying.
And what's weird about it is I wasn't familiar with their act, but I knew your name, like, outright, because I like WTF with Marin, Doug Benson's podcast, fantastic, and you know, those are folks that you'll get the odd reference here and there, and so you're somebody that I was aware of. I'm also somebody who loves, you know, I love stand-up comedy. I've always loved stand-up comedy. When I was a kid, my sister got the first Eddie Murphy album, where he's got, is it the one where he's got the flower behind his ear? And I just remember laughing my ass off. The bit about his dad promising to get him and his brother bikes if they could kick his ass, and how we whooped the shit out of that old man. I mean, ever since then, I was like, okay, there's something about this that I fucking love here. What was it that pulled you into comedy?
What was it that pulled me into comedy? I think it was also, like, the way you describe your love for Eddie Murphy. Like, I forget who it was. Well, you know who the original Saturday Night Live guys, the original ones with Belushi and Aykroyd and Chevy Chase,
so,
and seeing Steve Martin at the beginning of his career.
Oh, yeah.
You just, when comedy is good, there's a certain ecstatic abandon to it, or there's certain joy. There's an intense joy to great stand-up. And I came from a household that didn't have a lot of love in it, and intense depression, intense anxiety. And so you see something that makes you laugh that hard, and you're like drawn, like I want to do this, like mm-hmm. that's the place
yeah.
I want to
yeah.
go to, is that intense joy. And so I just gravitated to mm-hmm. that. And then I think it's because I always loved making people laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Again, to go back to my dad, you know, the only times that were happy was when I made my dad really
yeah.
laugh
yeah.
at stuff, and mm-hmm. then make my friends laugh
right.
at it. You know, it's like a typical story of a comic who the only way he could get attention or love is by making people laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Well, and making the dad laugh is such a
yeah.
big thing. I remember watching an Alan King special with my dad.
I liked
dad
Alan
once,
King, too.
And I thought I was going to have to call an ambulance because my dad, color drained from his face, and he could not stop laughing. And it was a bit where Alan King was talking about his dad taking a crap and needing to use a canary, like they were digging for coal to see whether or not they could survive going into the bathroom. And I seriously thought my father was going to die right before
yeah.
my eyes.
Well,
watching
you know,
it.
Comedy. And that's the great thing about good comedy is that it's a tremendous release of tension,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and I think people will appreciate
yeah.
that.
And when what's interesting to me, though, is mentioning that early cast of Saturday Night Live, if you look mm-hmm. at it, that group on paper, when you look at their styles, Steve Martin, Dan Aykroyd, Belushi, they are all so different in the way they approach comedy. Logically, that shouldn't work, but it
right.
did in such a beautiful way, and that's something so amazing about comedy is how, shit, that shouldn't be funny. But
yeah.
you'll see something that just sticks and
yeah.
kills, and
yeah.
you can't shake it. And
yeah, it's also a great way to turn things on its head. Comedy,
mm-hmm.
like you could just kind of completely flip things if
uh-huh.
you have a certain viewpoint.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like you just take a different angle. Like I can't think of. Like a bit, I remember hearing Robert Klein. I used to
oh,
love
God,
a lot.
Robert Klein,
I remember him. I can't stop my leg, but I remember him talking about something like abortion
mm-hmm.
as a horse race. Here comes abortion on the outside, and it's the pill on the inside, and it's the pill. It's no on. Here comes no. No is coming. Like the way a woman would, you know, not
yeah.
have a child. You
mm-hmm.
know, he did it as a horse race, and I think it's just so funny when comedy does something like that. Like it. It takes a very serious subject and it turns it on its head, you know? Mm.
Well, it was like Chris Rock when he did Bring the Pain, and it was, which
mm.
I still stand by as possibly the greatest, like, hour of stand-up that's
it's
been
good,
put out
yeah.
in the past
so good,
15
yeah.
years. It is so solid. But his coming up with it, where it's like, I don't want to just make you laugh. I want to make you think. And
yeah.
I want you to understand why it's funny, because
I don't think there's enough comedians like that.
Yeah. Well, because it's hard. I mean,
yeah.
being smart is hard.
Being smart and having the courage to go
yeah.
deep.
Yeah.
And that's a guy like Bill Hicks.
Yeah. Hicks. Well, and part of it was Hicks just, he got started so young.
That's true. I'm jealous of
yeah.
that. I didn't get started like that.
And pretty quickly learned, just fucking do it. Who cares? Just let this happen. And
right.
and just being there. But there are those handful of folks that just early on, had it, you know, that we're able to get that across. But
yeah.
what's fascinating to me about it is how within that you've got those guys who hit it, and a lot of them don't really have the staying power. They aren't able to make it work. And
mm.
like with you have been able to, even though you haven't had that massive break where everyone knows you make it work, and you've got that, you know, you've been building this career
right.
for so long.
Right.
To where
I have been doing a lot of TV.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know, just different shows like mm. Flight of the Conchords,
so
It's Always Sunny in Philly, the Sarah Silverman Program, like good shows,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's really the last few years that you've kind of taken off a little bit. Your career's kind of become a little bit more mainstream,
right.
I think, in the last few years. I think you were working as a waiter in New York for a number of years, right?
Yeah.
Before you...
Mm-hmm.
But
I was doing comedy all the time.
Sorry, I'm OCD, so I always have to check and make sure. It's like, because me and my partner have gotten to the end
these
of
These are great, though.
Oh, they are.
Yeah, yeah.
Me and my partner on a laptop had gotten to the end of a two-hour-long show before and hit a button
Everybody.
And it vanished. And we were
yeah.
like,
Everybody.
What the... Oh, fuck
yeah.
this. No, we're done.
Yeah.
Like, we couldn't
Well, don't
even
worry.
Try
if this, if this vanishes, we'll do it again.
Yeah, we've got this. Here we go. Now, what I want to ask in the comedy world here, what... Right now, I think Louis C.K. is setting the bar and just kind of redefining what comedy is. I mean, is that an overstatement? And not just what comedy is, but how comedy.
You mean with his show?
With his show and with how he was doing the self-release of tickets, the self-release of his thing. I mean, he's kind of shifting the paradigm of how comedy is marketed and put out to people and maintaining control. Is that something that you're seeing spread out more, or is he just a total exception to the rule?
Well, no, I think he is setting the example for other comedians to release their own stuff through their own websites, and they don't have to use a middleman and stuff. He's just got much more popularity and a forum with his show on FX, and
that show.
He's also like the guy who creates the most material of any comedian. That's what comics really admire about Louis, is that he's doing, I think, an hour every year. That's a lot to do.
Well, he said at the George
he's
Carlin...
He's a comedy machine, that guy.
Well, he said at the George Carlin, George Carlin Memorial, he's like, George Carlin does an hour a year, and I just, when I heard that, I thought, well, that's what you do. If I'm a comedian, that's how you do this then.
Right.
But what I find fascinating about him is how you're familiar with his show, I trust. Mm-hmm. It felt for a while like he was figuring out what to do with it, and this past season... The three-part one about Letterman, I think, is the best.
That was so good.
That was the best.
Well, here's the thing. Here's the thing about Louis' show, and someone said this to me the other day. What they love about Louis' show is that you don't know where it's going.
Yes.
And that, to me, is so rare on television.
Yeah.
Like, you put on a sitcom, you know where the fucking thing is going in the cold opening.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, in the theme song, you know where this show is going. Mm-hmm. Click, I'm going home.
Yeah.
But with Louis' show, it's so interesting. It's like, what is he going to fucking do now? To me, now, Louis' show is not, it's not even comedy anymore. No, they're like little short films.
I've said that for a while. You don't even know what show you're going to get that week.
Totally.
Yeah, I actually heard he's taking a year off, though.
Really?
Is he why?
From the TV show. I think he wants to focus on his stand-up. Well,
and also, that cat is such...
That's weird.
He cuts the episodes himself. I mean, that level of control, after a while, you got to just say, okay, I'm stepping back. I can't keep up this pace for forever here.
Yeah. I can't believe that he does that much. And it does make you look at yourself like a comedian and go, holy shit, I should be putting out more.
I need to get, I
need to be getting more serious. He's just got that, all successful people, one thing they have is laser focus.
Oh, yeah.
Laser focus.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they have people who do things for them and they're...
That's true.
Focus for them.
Right, yeah. Or they just watch lesser known comedians and take not mentioning any comedians by name here. But that's my
That's been put out there.
Yeah, I'm a big Joe Rogan fan too.
Yeah.
So I got that. His podcast is fantastic.
Yeah,
it's now I've got to ask, what made you decide to open up just in general to the idea of a documentary? Because it's a fairly invasive procedure. Yeah. What made you say, this is the time when I want to have this guy with a camera in my life?
You know what? I think because I'm a guy who sees that your life is really what your comedy is about.
Mm-hmm.
And being an artist, the more you reveal to people, the better it is.
Yeah.
And... I mean, I was just ready to do it. It's a combination of narcissism and altruism. You know what I mean? Like, the narcissistic part is, it's all about me.
Yeah.
And the altruistic part is, maybe if I show my life, it'll help other people.
Right.
I've really had some people come up to me and say, thank you for doing that, for letting Steven... have a career. I mean, for letting Steven film you. because it's helped me to see your difficulties and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What?
You're awesome. Yeah.
Let me say that it's not just Eddie's life. It's his stand-up, too. It's a lot of stand-up. The movie's...
That's very true.
So it's not just my...
But my stand-up is my life.
And what's fascinating?
Well said.
What's fascinating is when you go into that sort of thing, is it's like what Rogan said. He goes, think about the mentality of this. My job is, I stand on stage with a microphone, and you're not allowed to talk. And if you talk, I can have you thrown the fuck out. what does that tell you about me? That's what I chose to do as a young man. And I mean, now, what I'm wondering is, in the career that you had, how have you seen stand-up change?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I think it's actually interesting where I think these days it's gotten less interesting. I think stand-ups tend to reflect the world around them, and I think the world has gotten mean-spirited.
Yeah.
I think a lot of comedy can be mean-spirited. I think a lot of it can be super shallow, like just people talking about sex and getting high. And I think that goes on a lot. But then there are guys like Doug Stanhope, like we were talking about, who and Louis and Patton Oswalt and Dana Gould, who really do some interesting things with the art form. So I think it's an up and down thing.
Right.
In my day now, since the internet and all this stuff, is everybody thinks they're a star.
Yeah.
Like, everybody thinks they could just... And comedy's gotten very popular, so everybody and their mother is on stage grabbing a microphone. So there's a lot of shit out there.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And that brings the level of it down, because there are too many people, quote-unquote, doing comedy.
Right.
They're fucking just people... You know what? You know, I was having this conversation with somebody else. The job market is so bad that people are going, well, fuck it, I'll do comedy. I'm serious. People who should be in banking or accounting are fucking getting on stage. I'm not kidding.
Oh, my God.
I'm not kidding. And they're getting on stage thinking they can be a comedian because they saw Last Comic Standing or they saw, you know, all these shows. Like, I could do that, and they can't.
Well, and the thing that they forget is that the really good stand-up comedians make it look like they're literally just coming up with it.
And one big thing that so many people don't know is that it takes many years, many years, to become a decent stand-up comedian.
To find your voice at all.
Well, I don't want to get that pretentious about finding your voice.
Well, it was like it was like I found it fascinating, the Jerry Seinfeld documentary Comedian, where he's like, I'm just starting from scratch.
And he's so full of shit, Seinfeld.
Really?
I think. Yeah, when he says he's just starting from scratch, he's like, come on, he's a mega billionaire.
Yeah.
You know why I pissed at Seinfeld? Because he never really lets people in.
Yeah,
he's a mega billionaire and he just talks about bullshit. You know,
what's
the deal with cheese and the crust of pizza? That's the last thing I remember Seinfeld saying.
This will be cut from the show.
Why? Why?
I'm just
We don't.
No, I find him to be like the master of making the shallow funny.
Okay.
Oh, the show is great. Seinfeld is great. You like Seinfeld the show, right?
I like the sitcom, yeah.
But you also, with that, you also had Larry David's hands in there moving around. Larry David's one that blows my mind because, you know, when you read up on Saturday Night Live, he's a guy that was too ahead of Saturday Night Live to get shit on the air. And then everything that they turned down on SNL became an episode of Seinfeld.
Right.
So it's one
of those... Well, you know, another comedian I forgot to mention who I love is Albert Brooks.
Oh, Brooks.
What a funny guy.
His appearances on Carson back in the day.
Oh, man.
When he imitated Marlon Brando by putting the pieces of hot potato in his mouth.
Oh, shit. I never saw that.
Oh, my God.
I got to Google that.
Johnny looked like he was going to piss his pants because he cut it. He's like, okay, right. And he put him in and he's like...
Oh, my God.
And it was so... it might have been Brando. It might have been somebody else. But he put these
hot
potatoes in it.
You know who else I meant to tell you, too? Another guy with Brooks in his name. Mel Brooks.
One of my favorite
all time.
You want to hear the funniest thing about Mel Brooks? You know what his kid does now?
What?
His kid is like the world's greatest zombie expert.
Yeah, Max.
World War Z was his book. He is... If there is ever a show about zombies, Max Brooks is the expert on it.
What does he do with zombies?
He writes books and talks about it.
Survival guide or something like that?
Yeah, he wrote the Zombie Survival Guide. He's a zombie expert. How fucked up is this country that we have college...
You know what? I hate to tell you, but I think fucked up. I think this obsession, and this is not an original thought, but this obsession with vampires and zombies is an obsession with death.
Oh, yeah.
A total obsession. Like, what the fuck is this culture about?
Mm-hmm.
And the Twilight stuff is vapid and teenage soap operas.
I teach fucking high school.
Tell me about it.
Oh, Jesus.
Tell me.
Christ.
You must be sick. That Twilight stuff is indicative of how dumb the country has gotten.
Yeah.
Dumb and stupid and death-like. Like vampires, zombies, it's all boring.
I will tell you, it would do your heart proud. The number of 14 and 15 year old girls in my classes. I'm like, Twilight, like, I hate those books.
Oh, thank you so much.
I didn't think
there were anybody like that.
The number of young girls who are now taking offense at the way those movies make them, those books make them look. I'm like,
so who are the idiots who are selling all these movies and books?
It's yes, there are some of those, but the great mass are still like, oh my god, he's so dreamy, and the plain girl, like, it's just the saddest, the saddest goddamn thing. But there are, there is, it's that every time I'm about to just give up, you get the one who's like, no, it's stupid, she should, why do they want to be with her? She's annoying. This is a, like, oh, guys, I want to just thank you for once again restoring my faith for at least a minute here. So with this movie, what's the move forward from here? I know you're saying you got some video on demand distribution, you got stuff coming up through iTunes. For people out there, because we are a global phenomenon on this show, okay? We have people all over.
I can just see people in the Congo going, turn it up! They're talking about the Beatles Buddha!
That asshole's talking about how important he is again. Right? We got people in China, and we got people in Australia, New Zealand. Yeah. Oh, wow. I can look stuff up. I had a download in Israel, followed immediately by a download from the Islamic Republic of Iran. Back to back, we bridge the culture. We are... Seriously, we're healing the wounds that time couldn't heal. Mm. And for all those people out there that could benefit from seeing this film, where could they see it publicly displayed as it is intended to be seen?
Well, first things first, follow at the Bitter Buddha on Twitter, because that's where you're going to get all the updates.
Okay.
The film's going to be coming out in February in the U.S. On video on demand, maybe 10 to 15 cities. But in terms of like the U.K. and maybe some other countries, I think it's looking maybe like May, June.
Okay, outstanding, outstanding. Start pushing that, getting that out there. I'm glad to hear it, because the one thing that frustrates coming to festivals like this are the number of amazing films that fucking nothing happens with.
Like, are you serious? That come to the festivals?
Well, not nothing, but they come out and then they vanish, and you'll see them, like, you know.
Because they don't get distribution.
Yeah, they don't get distribution, or they get distribution. You got distribution. That's the beauty. But even films like a couple years ago, there was a documentary that is called Exporting Raymond. I think it was one of the best movies I've seen in years. It's fucking fascinating.
I saw it in L.A., though.
Yeah,
to Russia.
They went to Russia. Yeah. I thought it was the best movie I saw that year. And I don't think it didn't get the attention or the distribution it should have. But I don't understand that
because the Raymond people have a lot of money.
Yeah.
So I don't get that.
Yeah, but that's how that movie's a fucking weird business, man.
Yeah, I know it is. Well, hopefully this will get... You know, I mean, this is definitely a niche market movie, I think, right?
It is, but, you know, people are going to find Zach Galifianakis and Patton Oswalt and Robert Barron, and then they're going to find and that whatever gets them to Eddie is all that matters, and that's important.
The way I always look at it is no matter how small the market is, if it's genuinely good, it's going to find stuff. It's something that Steve Odekirk said in an interview. He was talking about a guy. He said, if you have a truly great screenplay, and you're in L.A., you could throw it out the window of your car and it'll eventually get made.
That's probably true.
Great.
I think that's probably true.
And he actually used an example.
Because someone's going to come across it and go, what the fuck is... Reed, look at this.
And he actually used for a while the exception to that rule as being John Malkovich, because it's like you had to have Malkovich and it's kind of creepy. And they thought it would never get made, but it was a great script and it eventually got made. And that's what I think is great movies eventually find their audience.
Well, yeah, with the internet and word of mouth and all that. Yeah, oh, yeah. It can really be.
Well, I mean, simply the fact that with on video on demand that it's possible that you could get it like this when we release it will literally be international instantaneously, and we will have downloads in England and Ireland and China and Australia at the exact same time. So I love the fact that, you know, even though it's just some asshole with a recorder talking to you after your movie,
it's something I can do
because I feel like, you know, in doing a show like this, I'm not a responsibility, but I feel like I owe it to the people who make the movies to try and help the good shit get found. And I mean, I'm huge on documentaries, so, you know, something like this
I find that so many people love documentaries.
Yeah.
When I talk to people, they're like, oh, I love documentaries. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because I think people are hungry for the truth.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Which documentaries, they're hungry for things that aren't a bombastic action flick.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I think that's another thing. When I go to the movies and I see all these trailers, they're all the same trailer. Yeah. I forget who said this, but it's like Hollywood is making one movie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And, well, the trailer, it's all about, you know.
The trailers have the exact same rhythms.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Every one of them.
How boring is that? How fucking boring is that?
Mission Impossible. It's the same vibe of every single one.
It pisses me off that, you know, you have Transformers comes out and everyone hates it, but it makes all the money in the world. Yeah. But a movie like Dear Zachary can't get a fucking theatrical release. If you haven't seen Dear Zachary,
it'll
fucking rip your soul out.
Yeah, it's gut-wrenching.
It is. It's basically a guy's best friend from childhood is murdered by his girlfriend.
Wait a minute, I saw it.
Yeah, and
I wanted to kill myself after that movie.
I wanted to go punch every judge in Canada square in the fucking skull.
I saw that
movie. And that didn't get the release it should have. I mean, that was a movie that. I called my parents afterwards to tell them to see it, and it was the most embarrassing thing because I was like, well, Dad, you need to. And
I hate to tell you, but what's going on there is that the powers that be, i.e., corporations and the advertising and the studios, everything is big business, right?
Yeah.
Studios who put out these movies, the people who advertise for these movies are all interested in keeping people dumb.
Yeah.
And a movie like Dear Zachary is about how the laws are fucked up.
Yeah.
And they don't want that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know?
Oh, no. Uh-uh. Yeah.
They want fat, dumb, happy. Yeah, fat, dumb, happy.
Yep, yep.
Now, isn't that true, though?
It's totally true. Oh, God, yeah, that's
Kevin
what
James.
Kills me
so
about
Kevin
it.
So Kevin James, basically.
Adam Sandler is a scourge to movie making.
Yeah.
That whole genre... By the way, I'm really hard on Hollywood comedies. I feel like they're all the same movie, too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's because...
They're all about men, children, man-child, you know, the fat guy, the pretty girl. It's like, get the fuck out of here.
The funniest thing, there was a woman on a panel yesterday talking about how she got hired to do a rewrite, like an update of Cactus Flower, the Walter Matthau Goldie Hawn. And
Goldie Hawn,
10 years later, nothing happened with it. 10 years later, her lawyer called and said, well, this Adam Sandler movie, Just Go With It, come out. Do you want to sue? She's like, what do you mean? And he walked her through how her script for Cactus Flower shifted through all these things and ended up becoming this Adam Sandler film that had absolutely nothing to do with Cactus Flower. But you could follow a paper trail that linked them together. And she was like, I'm going to walk away from this one.
Good.
I don't need to deal with this shit right now. But yeah, so I know that you guys have had a long day. I know you've got a lot of shit going on. And first off, I want to thank you for your time. It's fucking great of you at, you know, 9 o'clock after a screening to sit down with me and talk.
Thank you, Jim.
But seriously, you guys have my card. Get in touch any way you can. And also throw out any, right now this is yours. How do they get in touch with you? How do they keep in track? You know, Twitters, Facebooks, websites, all of that stuff.
For the movie, it's at The Bitter Buddha, and then on Twitter and on Facebook, it's The Bitter Buddha. Just find us there. And then also, I'll give Eddie a couple shout-outs here. The Puddin' Strip on YouTube is his webcomic, which is hilarious, by Matt Oswalt. And also, the Long Shot Podcast with Eddie and Sean Conroy.
All right.
Great. So check them out. Before you see the movie.
And also, you can go to my website, eddiepepitone.com. I also did a short film that won a lot of awards called Runyon Just Above Sunset. And it's a spoof on all these Mount Everest documentaries.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I want to thank you for doing this, and thank you guys for listening. Remember, like Eddie says, the only way to get a woot-woot is if you promise to read a book at some point in your life. Go out and get smart, fuckers. All right. Hey, well, thanks for checking us out. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Next week, we're going to do our wrap-up where we go over all the stuff that we actually did as part of the festival. You're going to hear about the panels, the screenings, and all of that. But in the meantime... Check us out at thefilmthugs.com, and while you're there, click on a link and jump on over to amazon.com. That way you can buy stuff the way you normally do, not get charged anything more, and we'll get the beak moistened a little bit and, you know, keep this train rolling. You can also check us out on Facebook. You can see us on Twitter. Both places were The Film Thugs. If you'd like to send us a voicemail, you can do that at thefilmthugs@gmail.com. If you have any questions or if you would like some of our stickers or something like that, go ahead and let us know through there as well, thefilmthugs@gmail.com. God, what else? Oh, yeah, if you want to talk to us, you can leave us a voicemail at the area code 512-666-RANT, or you can call us on Skype at the_film_thugs. That pretty much sums it up. So until next time, take care of yourselves and...
something funny and inspirational. Bye-bye.